We're live and we're local. This is a Juno Afternoon on Wednesday, March 7th, 2017. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. On today's show, we'll get a preview of the upcoming production by the Juno Douglas Little Theater. We'll hear Scott Burton's interview with Paula Poundstone in its entirety. Link Olson will be here to talk about Alaska's hoary marmots. And we'll get our weekly Eagle Crest update with Jeffer Clow. Those interviews, national native news, bird note, music, and more coming up next on Juno Afternoon. But first, a look at weather. There is a winter weather advisory in effect until 3 a.m. tomorrow morning, Thursday morning. And by that time, we'll have new snow accumulation of around 3 inches. National Native News is next.
With National Native News, I'm Daisha Eaton in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Durango Herald reports that Navajo filmmaker Cody Daish was released on a $25,000 bond Monday after being arrested Saturday following sexual assault allegations. The allegations spur from an incident that occurred at a hotel on Friday while the 29-year-old from Shiprock was in Durango for the Durango Film Festival. He was there showing his short, Spared, a story of two families struggling with violence. The victim, a 24-year-old woman, claimed she was lured to a hotel by Daish through Facebook to model for a photo shoot, where she says he tried forcing her to have sex, locked her in a bathroom, and held her phone. Court records show she called police around 12:30 a.m. She asked that bail remain at the original amount of $250,000. However, a judge released Daish without posting any money. If Daish violates the terms of the bond, he will be taken into custody and could be forced to pay a $25,000 bail. Daish denies that he held the woman captive. He was also arrested on suspicion of false imprisonment in addition to a felony sexual assault charge. Daish has a previous domestic violence battery charge in 2013 in New Mexico. Prosecutors say alcohol was involved in the incident. In addition to the bond, the judge imposed a protection order for the victim, as well as a condition that Daish cannot consume alcohol and will be regularly drug tested. Daish is scheduled to appear in court again on March 16th, where it's expected that he'll face formal charges by prosecutors. A Native organization is working to create opportunities for artist entrepreneurs. First Peoples Fund, which supports artists and culture bearers, provides professional development for tribes, organizations, and community members. Jeremy Staub is program manager with First Peoples Fund. He says learning skills such as marketing, pricing, and photography, and how to use online tools can enhance the Native art business.
It's really great to have the conversation on how to be a better artist as far as a business side of art, but at the same time, it's pointless unless we have the conversation on cultural values and then work with artists and coaching them on growing their arts business and taking it to the next stage, however they determine that, because we all have different definitions of success in our lives.
Malesio Benali is a Navajo artist who travels to art shows to promote his work. Benali says many artists in Indian country do this type of artistic entrepreneurship and says for an artist to stand out in the crowd, it's important to promote their work.
Pretty much try to be yourself, be unique about your pieces, kind of find your own trademark, just so you're kind of separating yourself from other artists as well, just so you're known out there in the Native art world. And then, of course, at the same time, make sure you have the business cards and all the contact information just in case people do want to add on and such forth and find you in the future if they can't find you at an art show nearby.
Staub says many artists spend a lot of time perfecting their medium, but don't spend enough time learning the business of art. And that's where professional development can come in handy. Staub and Benali are taking part in the National Reservation Economic Summit this week in Las Vegas, where tribal and business leaders across Indian country are receiving training and discussing business opportunities. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs is launching a tribal outreach effort to encourage Native veterans to apply for disability and pension benefits. Department representatives are traveling to at least 20 tribal communities in 11 states, stretching from Alaska to Oklahoma. VA officials are urging veterans to attend the events to find out whether they're eligible for veterans' pensions or for what are known as presumptive disabilities. Some widows of veterans may also be eligible. The agency is launching the first event on the Navajo Nation March 21st. With National Native News, I'm Daisha Eaton.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Kewaunee Broadcast Corporation announces the Alaska Native Art Auction, April 4th in Anchorage, Alaska. See amazing artwork from across the Alaska Native community. Reserve a table or donate art at knba.org. Proceeds benefit Native news programming. Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon. I'm your Wednesday host, Shelley Delaney, and with me in the studio are Grace Lee and Richard Carter. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank
Hi.
You.
Hi.
Hi. You're here to talk about Juno Douglas Little Theater's upcoming production, Next to Normal. But first, I wanted to ask, for those who don't know, what is Juno Douglas Little Theater?
So Juno Douglas Little Theater, it's a community theater. It's a nonprofit. We've been around for a number of years, and every once in a while, we emerge and bring a stage production to Juno to entice the people and get more folks engaged in the arts and acting and helping produce shows specifically. It's kind of our mission is to get people to dip their toes in the water, and then maybe that leads them toward Perseverance or other professional theaters. And we most recently did Women Playing Hamlet, as well as Five Lesbians Eating a Quiche. And Juno Douglas Little Theater usually likes to partner with other people in the community who have ideas for shows, who can bring us a pitch with a budget and a general production calendar or schedule. And we provide the financial backing and some of the resources like lights and, you know, the manpower to make it happen. And in this particular instance, Julia O'Connor, who is the director, and Haley Duran, who is the choreographer who worked on West Side Story recently, are partnering with Juno Douglas Little Theater and alongside Grace Lee here, who is the music director, to bring this to the stage.
Okay. So, Grace, you're the music director. Richard, what's your role?
So I am on the board of Juno Douglas Little Theater, and I am also cast in this production as Gabe, who is the son in the story.
Great. And apart from being the music director, Grace, do you have any other roles with Juno Douglas Little Theater?
Yes, I am also on the board. I am the treasurer of the Juno Douglas Little Theater. I am the music director for this musical, and I also play piano in the band, and I'm also a producer.
Wow.
The musical. I'm wearing a lot of hats.
Yes. And you guys are both so multi-talented. It's great to have you here today. And I'm excited about talking about this production. Next to Normal is a big deal for a lot of reasons. Could one of you give me a little background about the story itself, the book it was based on? What do you know about this play? Sorry, rock musical.
Thank you. Yeah, rock musical. Definitely stands out among musicals, I think. You know, it's a really touching story, and I think when most people think musical, they think very campy and eccentric and kind of just crazy and kooky, and there are definitely moments of that in this musical, but it also touches on some really serious and poignant topics about mental health and family dynamics, and I think it really just is a very engaging show, and I don't want to talk too much about why the director chose this show in particular, except that, you know, she saw it produced elsewhere and was very inspired to bring it back to Juno. So
I will add that this show did win Tonys and a Pulitzer Prize, and so this is a very lauded show when it first came out in the 90s. And you can tell by the quality of the writing of the show, and the music is amazing. It's so much fun for the band to play. We always enjoy doing it, and I know that people love hearing the music as well. So even though it does touch on serious subjects, and we don't want to get too into it for fear of spoilers, it's definitely a toe-tapper, and you will come out singing at least two or three of the songs.
Oh, good. And we're going to hear one of those songs in just a bit. So we have been kind of circling around the topics, the themes that the play touches on, and why Juno Douglas Little Theater decided to take it on. But this is also being presented in partnership with JAMI Health and Wellness. So can you say a little bit about how that came about, or what role JAMI plays in this production?
So when after a few weeks of working on this show, we thought that it was very important, because this musical touches and is so heavily influenced by with themes of mental illness and a family struggling to deal with not just a person's mental illness, but how mental illness affects an entire family, that it was important to have professionals involved. Especially, we wanted to make sure that we were handling this subject with the respect that it deserves. And so we reached out to Doug Harris from JAMI, who I know from mental health court in the court system. And he took it up to his CEO, and it's just been one of those match made in heaven where JAMI definitely wanted to partner with us, and I think is also very important that they partner with us. We will be having two after show talks on after our Sunday matinee shows with members of JAMI. I think we have a clinical director. Oh, who do we have?
We have a case management supervisor who's Freya McKay. She's been there for a number of years, and we also have Rachel Gearhart.
And they will be there after the Sunday shows to talk about the issues that were presented in the musical, of which there are many, many issues that people may not be familiar with.
That's great. I like that. I like it. Kind of adds an interactive element to the play.
Definitely.
All right. Now, you already mentioned Next to Normal has won several awards, 3 Tonys and a Pulitzer, no big deal. So as a theater company, were you intimidated by that when deciding to put it on?
I think the most intimidating thing is Broadway shows and musicals in particular are usually very expensive and very elaborate. So I think a lot of the nerves came from, is this something that we can pull off? And then you're always thinking about, you know, in what ways can we make it different and strip things down, make them more intimate, or change the style of the production for to fit our needs and to fit this community. But to see a show that's won a number of awards and to want to bring that to Juno, I think that's what most theater companies strive to do, is to look for the shows that have earned that recognition and people love them and they just need to be seen. So I think everyone was just really excited coming into the project.
Yeah, I like the idea of a rock musical. Lots of singing, lots of dancing. Your character has some songs. Is that right?
I do.
Would you like to talk a little bit about your character, Gabe?
Yeah, sure. Gabe is the son. He is almost 18, and he has a sister named Natalie, a father named Dan, and a mother named Diana. And he has a really interesting role in the family. You know, he gets along with his mother a little bit more than his father, and you know, there's a little bit of sibling rivalry between him and his sister. And, you know, the mental illness, the way that it plays into the family dynamics, and it kind of comes into play in the sense that some of the characters in the play are a little bit more understanding of some of the symptoms and some of the, I guess, the characteristics that are exacerbated by certain conditions or times of vulnerability in the characters. So my character is a little bit more understanding, I think, of the mother's situation. She's the one who is suffering from most of the mental health issues.
The title, Next to Normal, what does that mean, or what does it mean to you?
Well, I don't want to spoil anything, but I will tell the listeners that there is a song that explains exactly what that means towards the end of the musical. So if you want to know, you should come to the musical.
Don't
hold your breath, because they really do make you wait in anticipation for it.
All right, great. Well, this opens tomorrow with a pay-as-you-can preview. Are you ready?
Absolutely.
We are ready.
That's cool. And when and where is the show?
So it's at McPheeters Hall. It is starting tomorrow, as you said, with the pay-as-you-can at 7:30. We are opening on Friday, the 9th at 7:30 Saturday, again at 7:30 at McFeeters. And on Sunday, we have a 2 o'clock matinee show. And we are also going the next weekend, starting from Thursday to Sunday again with the same times. So we're very excited.
Yeah, 7:30 every night except for the 2 p.m. matinees. Mm-hmm. And we have the jammy talkbacks as well as with the probably some of the cast and crew after the Sunday matinees.
That's fantastic. I'm glad you guys are excited. I'm glad you guys are ready. Tickets are available where?
At Hearthside and at jack.org, so online as well, and at the door.
Fantastic.
Yeah, you can buy them in person at the Jack as well.
And where's the best place to find out more information, showtimes, all that stuff?
So Juno Douglas Little Theater has a Facebook page that we keep updated on there with all of our upcoming events and where to buy tickets and stuff like that. I actually was on there updating it today. So it should all be up to date with ticket dates and times. That's facebook.com/Juno Douglas Little Theater. Like us, find us, say you're interested or going to the event, and hopefully we'll see you there. If you have any questions, you can message us. We're usually, you know, we're a board of 7, so one of us will see it, and we typically respond within just a few minutes.
Fantastic. So I'm speaking with Grace Lee, Richard Carter from Juno Douglas Little Theater. The upcoming production is Next to Normal. It's a rock musical, and it opens tomorrow for a pay-as-you-can preview and runs this weekend and next weekend. Thanks for being here. And before we go, I've got a song from the musical, and I thought maybe you could set it up for us. This is called I'm Alive.
Okay. So this is one of my songs, Gabe, and he's singing this song as kind of his anthem in the first act to really just say, you know what, here I am. I'm coming into my own skin and I'm kind of accepting who I am. And it's about his relationship with his mother.
Great. Grace, Richard, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Worst fear, you'll find it in me. Come closer, come closer. I am more than memory. I am what might be. I am mystery. You know me, so show me. When I appear, it's not so clear if I'm a simple spirit or I'm flesh. I'm alive, I'm alive, I am so alive. But I feed on the fear that's behind your eyes. And I need you to need me, it's no surprise. I'm alive, so alive. I'm alive. I am flame and I am fire. I am destruction, decay, and desire. I'll burn. Darkest nightmare too. I've shown you I own you. And though you made me, you can't change me. I'm a perfect stranger who knows you too well. I'm alive, I'm alive, I am so alive. And I'll tell you the truth if you let me try. Believe in me. You
Every Alaskan can make a difference when they file online for their PFD. It's easy to share a little of your PFD with Southeast communities through Pick, Click, Give. There are dozens of nonprofits that you can support in Juneau alone, including KTOO Public Media. The application period for the PFD begins January 1st and runs through March 31st. For more information, go to pickclickgive.org.
Support comes from the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, helping you and your child save for college every step of the way, from diapers to diploma. More information at uacollegesavings.com.
You're tuned into a Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and my next guest is Link Olson, tonight's Wildlife Wednesday presenter, and Patricia Wary, representative of the Alaska Wildlife
Alliance.
Thank you. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Thank you, Shelley.
You're welcome. Link, apart from the talk you're giving tonight, what's your connection with the Alaska Wildlife Alliance?
Recent. They invited me to give a talk last year, and I looked into them a little bit and decided it was a great group that I'd like to support. I do come to Juneau fairly regularly, but this is the first time I've been in the winter. Although
really?
By Fairbanks standards, this isn't really winter.
Mm-hmm. I'm not even going to get into that with you. Winter is in the eye of the beholder.
That is true.
We're just happy to have some snow. All right. And what is the title of the talk that you're giving?
It's a very long title that I'll abbreviate. It's called Down from the Mountain, What Alaska's Beach Marmots Can Tell Us About Climate Change and Resilience in a Changing World.
Wow.
And it's about hoary marmots, which most people in Juneau, I think, are familiar with. It's the one species you have down here. And what's unique about marmots along South Central and Southeast Alaska's coast is that, contrary to what you read in books, they're actually found down at sea level, where they seem to thrive. And one of the questions we're trying to ask is why? If an iconic alpine mammal can survive well outside of its normal habitat, what does that have to say about its ability to respond to climate change?
That's interesting. Is it a new development that they're living at sea level, thriving at sea level?
We don't think so. And people in South Central, Southeast Alaska have known about it for years. It just happens to be that most of the scientists studying hoary marmots have been studying them much farther south, Washington State, British Columbia. And so what's a pretty well-documented phenomenon up here hasn't really made it into the scientific literature.
How did you conduct your research?
Our research is primarily field-based. We go out into the field as field biologists and specimen collectors. So my research is done through the University of Alaska Museum, which is based at UAF. And we typically go out and do small mammal surveys, try and document what species occur where. And over the course of the first few years I was here, we started noticing that there were marmots in places there weren't supposed to be marmots. And so I've turned that into a research program independent of some of our broader statewide survey work, and it's now being conducted, the research that is, by my graduate students.
Now, the hoary marmots in Southeast Alaska, do they only live at sea level?
No, they occur at just about every elevation that we've surveyed, including up in the highest stretches of the alpine. They can't live underneath ice, so there has to be exposed boulders and meadow vegetation for them to eat. And if you talk to most people who know what hoary marmots are, they will tell you that they are strictly alpine. So what they're doing at lower elevations is still a mystery. And there are situations where it seems pretty obvious alpine habitat can extend down to sea level in some parts of Alaska. But you can go to other parts where there's mature temperate rainforest, and yet we still see these ostensibly alpine organisms very far from the alpine.
The first marmot I ever saw here was on the beach.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
Oh. But I've seen them up as well on higher level trails. What do they eat?
They're vegetarians. They're strict herbivores. Occasionally they'll scavenge bird eggs, nestlings, and things, but they are pretty strict herbivores other than that. And one of the things we think they might be coming down to sea level for is to eat plants that don't occur in the alpine that may be more nutritious. It may provide nutrients that are lacking up in the alpine. We've had several colleagues at different management agencies send us observations of them eating kelp and other marine plants in the intertidal zone. So that's one avenue of research we're pursuing.
Do they encroach into the human habitat? Like, I'm sure we encroach into theirs, but do they get into the garbage, I guess, is what I'm trying.
They do. And, you know, I haven't heard reports from the Juneau area, but in Valdez, they can be a real problem in gardens and then climbing up underneath cars, because when we salt the roads, we create a layer of mineral that they really don't get access to in the wild. So they'll climb underneath cars and chew wiring, and they're actually kind of a problem for some of the people in Valdez. They do invade gardens. I don't want to give away the punchline of tonight's talk, but we think one reason they might be coming to lower elevations is that the soil is easier for them to dig. And so when we create these disturbed habitats that they could easily burrow into, that might serve as an attractant.
What are some of their predators?
Just about anything that eats meat and can catch a marmot will depredate a marmot, and that includes golden eagles are their primary predator, but bears, wolves, foxes, bald eagles. We've documented that bald eagles will take at least young marmots in the last few years. Anything that can catch a marmot and kill it will eat it.
Are they in any chance of being endangered, or are their numbers pretty good?
Hoary marmot numbers are really good right now in terms of the entire species. We are finding that there are some populations that are genetically distinct, especially on islands. And that's been another surprise, is that many of the islands off the coast of Alaska harbor thriving marmot populations. And some of those we know have become locally extinct. Now, whether they constitute a conservation concern in terms of their distinctiveness is something we're still trying to sort out.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Link Olson. He's tonight's Wildlife Wednesday presenter. You're a curator of mammals at the University of Alaska Museum.
Yes.
And also a professor of biology at UAF, and you're based in Fairbanks.
Yes.
How did you get into studying marmots?
That's an interesting story. I actually came to Alaska a couple of times to backpack in the Wrangells, and my predecessor at the University of Alaska Museum is a longtime friend and colleague of mine, and he encouraged me to visit Alaska. And then actually told me when he was planning of leaving that there might be a job opening. And the second backpacking trip when I came up here was kind of with an eye towards, could I live here and what would I study if I did? My research experience prior to moving to Alaska was entirely in the old world tropics. I keep one foot in Madagascar figuratively and literally, and was looking for a project that was amenable to the kinds of questions I'm interested in as a scientist. And it seemed that alpine mammals occur on these island-like ecosystems, and that's one thing that's very interesting to me as an evolutionary biologist. And marmots in particular are very good study organisms. They're diurnal. They're conspicuous. They're relatively easy to find where they occur. And I looked around, and there just weren't many people studying hoary marmots.
Do you ever get to handle the marmots?
Yeah, quite a bit, actually. And we've been collaborating with a wildlife veterinarian who's actually the world's only marmot veterinarian. And we borrow him every summer from the Vancouver Island Marmot Recovery Foundation. And he comes up twice a summer to help us catch and surgically implant these little devices that measure body temperature and heart rate. And then, of course, we have to remove those the following year. So he comes up several times every summer, has been for 5 years. We catch marmots. We do these surgeries. We recapture them when we can. And we spend a lot of time chasing marmots.
Yeah.
How do you trap a marmot?
We either chase them or we observe them going into their burrows. They're burrowers. And that's where they seek refuge, both from the weather and from predators. And if we're lucky, that burrow only has one egress, and we block the entrance with a cage trap, just like you buy at the hardware store. And then sometimes we wait and wait and wait. But eventually they come out, we trap them, we take them back to a surgical tent and start the procedure.
Do they have to be sedated?
Yes, they're anesthetized. They're put completely under.
Yeah. Is there any way they could do any damage to you? Like, I know they have teeth and claws.
Oh, they have teeth. Yes, I have scars. But that's mishandling on our part when we were first getting used to this. None of us has been bitten by a marmot in several years now. And when we did, we deserved it.
Nice of you to take ownership. One last question about marmots, and this might seem a little off topic unless you know where I'm going with it. But have you ever seen the movie The Big Lebowski?
Yes. And no, that is not a marmot.
Right. Well, we've all had that debate, right? It's a ferret as far as I know.
It is a ferret. And there's a nod to The Big Lebowski in my talk tonight.
Fantastic, because this week marks the 20th anniversary
of
the movie's release.
Not coincidental.
Okay, well, I don't want to ask any more questions about your talk. I feel like we're getting into some spoiler territory here. But thanks for indulging me. That was some great information. When and where is the Wildlife Wednesdays lecture?
This is our final one for the season, and we're doing it out at the university. It's in the lecture hall. That's the opposite end from the library. And next year, our audience said they preferred that location over the library, so we're going to try to be there next year for next season's talks.
Oh, well, and that's a great announcement.
Yeah, happening 7 to 8 this evening there. And we can still have goodies.
Always good to mention if there will be snacks. All right. Well, is there anything else that either of you would like to add about tonight's talk or Wildlife Wednesdays or the Alaska Wildlife Alliance?
Grateful for being able to come on to Juno Afternoons.
Yeah, thank you very much. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you. That was a fun one for me. And good luck with your talk.
Thank you.
Yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in. I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky. I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
I pushed my soul in a deep dark hole and then I followed it in. I watched myself crawling out as I was crawling in. I got up so tight I couldn't unwind. I saw so much I broke my mind. I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Davis Mountains of southwest Texas, the landscape dotted with oaks. An eerie trill erupts from the foot-tall grass. It's the Montezuma quail, a tiny, ornately patterned bird named for the Aztec ruler. Rows of bright white spots line the quail's black flanks. Its back is cross-hatched with shafts of gold, and elegant swirls of black adorn its white face. The quail's markings are bold and beautiful, but watch it hunker down on a carpet of fallen oak leaves or rest among lichen-covered stones, and it disappears into the brush as if invisible. The Montezuma quail is a secretive bird and a scarce one. Few birds are more highly sought after by birders visiting the Southwest. Mostly a bird of Mexican mountains, it reaches just into the southwestern United States. Habitat loss and overgrazing have reduced the range of this little bird. Without the right brush to hide in, the quail's camouflage isn't nearly as good. but it still holds its own in areas protected by the Nature Conservancy, Texas State Parks, and National Forests in Arizona and New Mexico. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation.
Support for KTOO is provided by Davies Berry Insurance, serving southeastern Alaska since 1917 with personal and commercial insurance, including homeowners, life, and health policies. 789-5900.
Join us for a public viewing of the documentary Inside Out, Leaving Prison Behind. The film follows three individuals as they're released from prison and struggle to rebuild their lives on the outside. Following the 30-minute screening, we'll have a panel discussion with experts in the field of recovery, incarceration, and reentry. Admission is free at 360 in the KTOO building on Wednesday, March 14th at 5:30 p.m.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon, and my next guest is Jeffrey Clow with our weekly Eagle Crest update. Welcome back.
Thanks, Shelley. Thanks for having me on this snowy Wednesday afternoon.
I know. I read the weather forecast at the top of the hour, about 3 more inches by the time the storm is over, and more on the way.
Yeah. So, you know, we're looking better and better. Every bit of snow helps us. I did check out the webcams. I didn't go up to the mountain today, but it has been snowing lightly up there pretty much most of the day. So kind of, I think it's accumulating more in Douglas than it is anywhere else. Certainly not at my house. It didn't look like it at Eagle Crest. But the good news is it is giving us something. It gives the Seth and the boys something to work with tonight, soften things up and help out those ramps. So we're excited, and there's certainly more snow in the forecast.
Yeah. So what kinds of things specifically will they be doing to get ready tonight?
Well, the snowcats, they come in and work about from usually their normal shift is midnight to 8. So they'll come in, they pack the snow, and they groom it, which is they have a machine that's called a tiller that kind of lays down a real nice packed groomed surface, kind of looks like corduroy. Mm-hmm. And that just makes everything real soft, and everybody loves to ski freshly groomed corduroy. So we're looking forward to some nice soft stuff. It was firm and fast on Monday, so this new snow will definitely soften everything up and just make it even more fun than it was on Monday. So we're excited.
Great. And what are the days and hours you'll be open now?
So we're open this week Thursday through Monday from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. So all lifts now have more daylight. So all lifts are operating until 4 o'clock. So it'll be this 5-day period. And then we'll be closed next Tuesday, Wednesday. And then starting on Thursday, the I think that is the 15th.
Yes,
anyway, next Thursday, we're open daily through Monday, March 26th for the spring break holidays. So the good news is the bus runs the weekend, and then that whole week that the kids are out of school and the snow bus. And so spring break is here, and we're excited. It looks like we'll have enough snow, and we'll be open.
That's great news.
Yeah.
Stretch out the season as long as possible.
Stretch out the season as long as possible. And, you know, one of the things, this is great, this new snow and everything for our season pass holders. But also, if you aren't a season pass holder, one big option, really cool option I wanted to let everybody know about is we do have multi-visit cards. And they go in by age group. And they aren't transferable by age group. So, you know, if you wanted to buy a 5-visit card, for example, and take 4 of your friends up skiing for the day, you could do that. So we have 5-visit, 10-visit, and 15-visit. So those are a great option for this time of year, especially if there's a few of you in the same age category, a couple of teenagers or some youth that just want to get some turns in and have a great time up on the mountain. And you can find information and pricing on that at skijuno.com. And you can also buy those multi-visit cards as well as gift cards online at skijuno.com.
Yeah, in case you need a spring break gift for somebody.
There you go, a spring break gift. Or, you know, maybe someone's got a March birthday, or, you know, you just want to be a nice guy and you're celebrating the new snow. Let's give your friend a 5-visit card.
Awesome. Well, that's all great news. I've been having a good time up there the last couple weekends, and Looking forward to going back up a few more times. Will there be a slush cup happening this year?
You know, we're sitting there. We talked about it on Monday, evaluating it. Part of the challenge is you have to have a pretty huge snow depth in order to build the pond, the slush pond, for it to be safe. So we're evaluating the snow. We may not have enough snow, but we're going to do something in celebration of the end of the season. So we'll have some fun stuff. So keep an eye on SkiJuno.com as we announce what our end of the season events are going to be. And, you know, we've got some great skiing and riding up on the mountain for all ability levels. I know I've seen you out on having a great time on Porcupine. And that's okay. Porcupine is an amazing lift and some great terrain there. But, you know, the mountain is just getting better and better. So come on up this week and make some turns with us on the mountain.
That sounds great. Check out the website, keep up to date, or tune in to a Juno Afternoon every Wednesday. Jeffrey's been coming in religiously to give us these updates. We really appreciate it. All right. Anything else to add, Jeffrey?
Nope. SkiJuno.com or find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Snapchat.
Yeah, your social media platforms are great as well for getting the word out. All right. Well, thanks for coming in. We'll talk next week.
Cyrano de Bergerac, soldier, poet, and musician, is clever, charming, and disarming, but believes he'll never win the love of the beautiful Roxanne. Through strength and wit, he fills his life with love, honor, and panache. Perseverance Theater presents Cyrano de Bergerac by Edmund Rostand, a world premiere translation and adaptation by David Grimm. See it March 16th through April 14th. Tickets at the Jack, Hearthside Books, ptalaska.org, and 463-TIXS.
Hey, it's Paula Poundstone here of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. I'm looking forward to seeing each and every one of you Junoans in Juno this week. My special show for KTOO is coming up this Thursday, March 8th at Centennial Hall. If you haven't bought your tickets yet, what are you waiting for? The last minute? Well, that's where we're at. Congratulations. You've successfully procrastinated. So stop posting yet another selfie of you with the glacier and get your tickets at ktoo.org, the station and the Jack.
As you heard, the show is tomorrow night. The doors open at 5 p.m. tomorrow, Thursday, at Centennial Hall. The show is at 7 p.m. Salt will provide a no-host bar. We're all very excited to hear Paula Poundstone, to watch her perform. And I have an interview coming up next with our arts and culture producer, Scott Burton. Got to speak with her on the phone in advance of her coming to Juno. So we're going to listen to the full interview right now here on a Juno afternoon.
Okay, Paul, can you hear me?
Yep.
All right. So we are.
Did it.
They won't put a note in my file today. Well, they probably will, but.
Not for this.
Well, we are so excited to have you up here in Juno. I was trying to remember, the last time you were here was 2012, and have you been there before that?
Had I been there before that, I don't remember.
Okay.
Maybe. One time I was in, I can't remember what city in Alaska I was in. It might have been Juno. And they sent a driver for me, and when I went out from the hotel to, you know, to the car to be driven to the venue, somebody flashed a, I don't know, like a police ID or a FBI ID, I forget which, and my driver was arrested before I could get the ride to the venue. But I forget where in Alaska that was. It's a rough and tumble area.
That was definitely not Juneau.
Oh, you don't think it was Juneau?
We don't have that kind of stuff in Juneau.
Oh, all right, good. Good, I feel sick. And then the last time I was there, they did take me to, they took me out on the glacier, which was great. I still have beautiful photographs from that. And then they took me to this, like, you know, nature observatory place there. And they had, like, a telescope or something, you know, lined up so that you could see some sort of creature in its den. But the creature wasn't in its den. And so we just watched, like, an empty apartment, you know, with the feeling that it might show up any minute.
Well, maybe the critter will be back on this trip.
I'm hoping. Very much hoping. I forget what it was. I forget what kind of, might have been a software developer. I can't remember what it was that was supposed to live in that den. Do you know? Have you been up there?
I do know of a beaver den that has a beaver cam in it.
Oh, yes, that's what it was. That's what it was. Yeah, it was like the Kim Kardashian of beavers, except for they were out when we were there.
yeah, well, let's hope that it's back. let's see. We are all, of course, as public media fans and listeners, huge fans of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And I was just wondering why you and that show's model are such a great fit. I was wondering how you would explain that, just your style of comedy and how that show works. What is it that explains the great chemistry that you have?
Well, you know, from the first time I was on the show and when I, my first, you know, trial run, back then we didn't have an audience in front of us and we were not all in the same room as we are now when you hear the show. Now we're somewhere. We're either in Chicago in the basement of a bank in this auditorium with about 500 people in front of us, or we're, you know, somewhere else around the country in some sort of theater. But we're all together. Whereas when I first started doing the show, you just went to the studio near your house, you know, wherever you lived, nearest your house, and you were hooked up via wire with everybody else, and there was no live audience. But from the minute I sat down in the chair and the show began, and they explained to me how it worked. I had never heard it before. But from the minute I sat down in the chair, you know, you wear a goofy headset. In my headset, the director would say, jump in anytime, say anything you want. That is extraordinary in the show business. In any, I can only think of, you know, one other time where anyone ever said that to me. And the fact that they bring people on, like myself, and allow them to, you know, do what they do, well, that's the that's the genius of it. Sorry, I'm joking to that. I have SARS. I don't think it's nearly as communicable as they say. The show business, as a general rule, has a very, very long history of hiring people and then telling them not to do what they do. So this was extraordinary. And I think it's just wise of them to do that. So we all, so you think of stuff and you say it. And, you know, sometimes it sticks. Sometimes it doesn't, I suppose. But for the most part, that sort of freewheeling feeling, the number one comment that I hear when people come up to me on the street and say something about Wait, Wait, is you guys sound like you're having so much fun. And you know what? We are.
That's great. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you started stand-up in about 1979?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. So what does that make it? 30?
I'm an English major, sorry. No help here.
Okay, wait. So it's 39, years. Is that right? If I started 78, no, 79, and now it's, yeah. I think it's 39 years. Oh, my gosh. That's big. It's got to be, because last year I kept saying 38 years.
Since 79 on that 39-year journey, when did you become so interactive with the audience and so improvisational? Because I think that's among the things people love about you.
Well, one time years ago I made an independent film. It's a very bad independent film, but it was an independent film. And we made it in North Carolina, and there was a scene where we needed a cow. We needed just one cow in a scene. And so we needed to separate out a cow from the rest of the cows on this ranch. So we go to this ranch, and I watch this man who was very soft-spoken, was the ranch guy. He says to his dog, which was about, a foot high, if that, teeny little dog, he tells it to go get a cow. And in a few minutes, the dog has gotten a cow. And then he says, practically whispers to this dog, he says, come by, Rose. Rose was the name of the dog. And it was the most extraordinary thing I've ever seen in my life. And I looked up at the guy afterwards, and I said, how the hell did you do that? And he said, the hardest thing is getting the dog not to do that. And that's sort of me as a comic, I think. From the very first time I went on stage as an open micer, you got 5 minutes, and there were lots of people who wanted to do open mic night, so you really were supposed to stick to your 5 minutes. And I had memorized these jokes I had written for myself. It was 5 minutes to the second. But the minute I got on stage, I saw something that distracted me. I forget what it was now. So I just talked to somebody, and, the next thing I know, I don't know where I am in time in my 5 minutes. And because I went over, and of course it makes everybody mad, now I figure, okay, the worst thing I can do is talk to somebody in the audience. I've never been able to not. And I forget at what point I finally figured out that I should drop the struggle not to, because that was the magic of the night. But I really, when I began, I thought it was like a liability. I thought it was like a really bad thing. It meant that I was somehow undisciplined, which I guess I am.
I guess that sort of segues into my next question about how you'll never do the same show twice. Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of material that I repeat, by the way. It's not like you'll come to a show and never hear something that you heard before. I think I've been doing my international House of Pancakes jokes for a solid 39 years. My act, for one thing, evolves as time goes on. When I first started out, I was talking about bussing tables and taking public transportation. And for the last, 20-something years, I've been talking about raising a house full of kids and animals. But I have, there's two things. One is, somewhere in my head, there's 39 years of material rattling around. And although my act is largely autobiographical, my favorite part of the night is just talking to the audience. I do the time-honored, where are you from, what do you do for a living? I've after all these years, embraced the flaw of being distracted by the audience. So I do the time-honored, where are you from, what do you do for a living? And in this way, little biographies emerge of audience members, and I use that from which to set my sails. And so I don't know what they're going to say, and therefore I don't know what I'm going to say, and therefore I don't know what the next, sometimes they'll say something that reminds me of a piece of material that I have, and I move in that direction. And other times, I just make stuff up that's unique to just that night. And I've purposely laid in into my act some things that I do where, I occasionally do a PowerPoint presentation, and I ask a person in the crowd if they've done a PowerPoint presentation before, to a group of people, and I ask them about what they do, and I go from there, because the PowerPoint presentation is the enemy of education and intelligent oration. And so there are, you know, points where I really have deliberately allowed myself to move away from anything scripted.
So, yeah, the where are you from and what do you do part, I listened to you do a bit, I think, in Maine once where you discovered a snow ranger.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And you said that was possibly the pinnacle of your career, and where do you go from there? Have you found the next snow ranger, so to speak?
I really haven't. The snow ranger was, and he was where his wife, as I recall, managed a forest. It was extraordinary, these people, because I have never heard of the position snow ranger. I didn't even know what to make of that. And he was great when you got him talking about it. That's the thing, too, about people. My manager tells people that I know who to talk to, which is such a load of crap. I have no idea. And by the way, half the time, I can't even see people because of the lights. I just, you know, hear, I ask a question and somebody responds and I hear a voice and I go, that guy over there. And sometimes it's not even a guy and we have to go through that. But you get anybody talking for a few minutes and they're just great.
All right. We have a stand-up comedy troupe here in Juneau. It's titled, their name is Club Baby Seal, and I'm sure some of the members of that comedy troupe will be at the show. What's your advice for young comedians?
My advice is do what's in your heart. You know, that will make you unique. You know, I mean, we're all not... You know, we are, and yet, you know, we're not polar opposites by any means. Even if you're talking on the same subject to someone else, likely you have your own unique take on it. But if you allow your relationship with the audience and what's in your heart to steer what you're doing, I don't think you can go wrong.
Okay. Well, I want to let you go here. Last question, Juno. What should we expect on Thursday night? What are you looking forward to? How should we dress? Anything like that, Paula?
Oh, I say dress comfortably. It's going to be a long night. I think I usually do about 2 hours, and so come early so you can use the bathroom. That's important, and. I don't know. I think you can expect a night of healing laughter.
And thinking of like the Snow Ranger, should people come in? You know, I guess you said you can't really see them, so maybe it doesn't matter if they like wear their uniforms or anything like that.
No, they needn't wear their uniform. I want them to be comfortable and happy, unless wearing their uniform makes them comfortable and happy. I'll be wearing my uniform. I'll be wearing a colorful suit, which is my uniform. It doesn't matter. It wouldn't matter what they wore. Wouldn't matter who came. There's always gold somewhere in the audience.
Well, Paula, we're so honored to have you up here and looking forward to it. See you on Thursday. Is there anything I should have asked or anything else you want to let us know?
Not that I can think of. I'm just looking forward to seeing you guys.
All right. Well, safe travels, and we'll see you on Thursday.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Paula.
That was Scott Burton's interview with Paula Poundstone. The show is tomorrow night. Doors open at 5 p.m. at Centennial Hall. The show is at 7. Thanks for tuning in to a Juno afternoon. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. Jeff Brown is the producer. Have a great Juno evening.